Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, each week we tell you that this conversation includes you and we really mean it. Our phone number is 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to use, or 877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream. Now, on the list of fun activities, budgeting probably doesn't make your top 10. It's tough, it's tedious, it's fraught with competing interests. In those ways, your budget may be similar to how the state budget is crafted, albeit with a lot more input from the governor and lawmakers to community members and lobbyists. But there the similarities may end. Hawaii is mandated to have a balanced budget, and how that happens is sometimes a mystery. Often, too, so is the accountability of how taxpayer dollars are spent. Tonight, we're going to look at how the state budget works, what's in it, what's not, and how financially healthy our state is or isn't. We'll also consider how well expenditures stack up with the accountability many people say they want, especially as directed by the state auditor. Joining us tonight is Wes Machida. He is the Director of Finance, and he heads the Department of Budget and Finance. He's the former Executive Director of the $14 billion Employees Retirement System of the state of Hawaii. And once, not all that long ago, he was the Assistant Auditor in the Office of the Auditor, which is where you'll find Jan Yamane. She became the Hawaii Acting State Auditor in December of 2012. Just prior to that, she was the Deputy Auditor and General Counsel for the Office of the Auditor. In this last year, she and her team have been quite busy. You might remember one of the largest auditor's reports was released last summer. And, of course, you're here, too. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 as we're taking a look at budget, finance, and accountability in the state of Hawaii. Welcome to both of you. Thank you so much for making the time to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Wes Machida, I want to start with you in that when people hear the budget, this great monolithic thing that says what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, very often there's the inclination to believe that there's something, you know, sort of pro forma about some of it, just because something happened in a year before, that that's going to carry over and happen this year too, or just the way things were. But we've seen some of that shake up. What do you think are some of the things about the crafting of the budget that most people don't know and should?
One of the things in terms of, we have to, as you mentioned earlier, balance the budget. One of the things that goes into balancing the budget and that we have to use by law is the council and revenue projections. So on the revenue side, we base our revenue stream based on the projections that the council and revenues report on. And they report on it every quarterly. And so we use that as a guide to determine the amount of revenues. Now, on the expenditure side, what's used is the appropriations, what's approved, in other words, by the legislature. And eventually what gets allotted for expenditure by the different departments in the way of providing the public services that they do provide for each of the departments and each of the Hawaii citizens. So there's a number of different components or elements that go into it. Just to give you an idea in terms of the size, the budget, the entire budget per year is about $13 billion, which includes about $6 to $7 billion of general fund monies. General funds are the pool of monies that come from taxpayers, as an example, that can be used for general purposes, as opposed to specific purposes that are in the special funds. And State Auditor Yamane can speak to that one, because I know that they do a special report on that as well.
And we're going to talk about that in a second. But in terms of understanding that there's only $7 billion that's in the general fund, that leaves a lot of money left external to that. That's the majority of it. Does that surprise most people to understand how much of the budget is driven by special funds?
Well, it's not only special funds, but it's also federal funds. And so federal funds make up about 20% of the entire state budget. So the remaining 30% or so, or actually less than 30%, probably more 20%, might pertain to special funds and other funds, because you do have other funds that are involved in the mix as well, too. So although the general funds make up about $7 billion out of the $13 billion budget, there's still other funds, like you said, the federal funds and the special funds and other funds besides special funds, revolving funds, that make up the difference.
That's still a lot of money, though, that may be earmarked in certain ways that might not necessarily even be relevant anymore.
Well, there are, though, a lot of special funds that are relevant, and I know that, you know, state auditor can speak to those that are relevant or may not be relevant. But a lot of the special funds, such as in the Department of Transportation, there's the airport division that has the landing fees that are used to operate the various airports statewide. There's a significant portion that goes to that. And then so there's other special funds that provide other services as far as health and human services.
Right, right. But in terms of the amount of fixed cost, I mean, for people who have businesses and say, okay, this is my overhead, this is what I have to do, here's the other part that may be fungible, how do you divide out what is truly a fixed cost as opposed to what may be something that could be a nice to have but not necessarily a must do?
Well, in terms of fixed costs, we have probably four major expenditure categories that cover the fixed costs. One would be the pension costs, the contributions that's made to the employee's retirement system. Then you have the contributions that are made to the EUTF, which is the health benefit system. And then you have the debt service, which is paid for all of the bond issues and the proceeds which are used for special projects, building schools, as an example, hospitals, and so forth. And then you also have the Social Security and Medicare contributions that are made from the payroll from the employees that are working statewide for the state government.
If you just joined us tonight on Town Square, we're talking about the state budget and also the peering over the shoulder to make sure that some of those funds and some of the issues that we talk about on Town Square a lot actually are a little more transparent. The state auditor is here, and as you just heard, we are talking to Wes Machida, who is the Director of Budget and Finance and heads the Department of Budget and Finance. How does our state budget work? Do you really know? Do you have a good handle on that? Tonight you might want to ask a question, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Sometimes it can be tough to think about the huge amounts of money that we talk about in millions, in billions. Most people can't really conceive of that because that's not something they walk around with in their own personal bank accounts. But yet those numbers are important to understand in terms of what they can do and what they can't do. Some amounts of money may sound huge, and yet when you break them down to what they're actually going to bring, it may not be so much. Is there a sense that we need to have some better understanding of what not just money itself, but what the money does and can do in a more approachable level than talking about all this in millions and billions?
I believe so. And that's one of the reasons for trying to issue reports to be more transparent, to have the information available so that people can understand where their monies are being placed, what are they being used for. And so with the reporting mechanisms that are in place, hopefully on the various websites that might be available and the materials, that more information can be provided to the general public at large, because they need to know, they really do need to know where their monies, their hard-earned dollars are being spent. There's so many different services that are needed to be provided to the public. And unfortunately, there's not enough dollars to provide all of the services that are needed. So obviously tough choices have to be made. And that's one of the difficulties about looking at the state budget and for the legislature in particular to decide where those money should be going.
We seem to hear those same words every year about tough choices having to be made, even when there seems to be a little bit more money than had been previously thought. And for most people, you know, having a pet department or a certain interest means that they tend to look at something rather myopically and not understand how it weaves together or fits together in government. We don't have a whole lot of discussions about how that happens. We have people who turn up for legislative hearings because they care deeply about that subject and they want to make sure they get their due. Is there something better that you think that we should be doing to engage people in general? And we know that that's a deep frustration just to get people to pay attention, let alone to go out and vote. But when you're trying to explain money and people who have to pay taxes, to give some more real understanding of why this has to fit together and weave together in such a way that it's not just a matter of this pet project or that one?
I think it's a matter of educating, and I think it's important for us to, even for myself, to go out as much as possible, whether it be in different meetings, different forums, to provide the information that's needed so that people can understand, better understand the process and where the monies are being used, as an example. So I think it's a matter of making ourselves, and myself in particular, more available to do such, you know, things like this as an example, so that we can better educate everyone out there, because they need to know what's happening. They need to know where their monies are going and what the future holds in store for, you know, the revenues that do come in the future.
And also the reserves that we have to carry.
And that's true, because it's important for us to have reserves. One of the things, as I mentioned before, is that we do bond sales. The rating agencies rate the financial stability, the financial condition of the state. And in doing so, they look at the sufficiency of reserves as one metric to determine how financially sound a state's budget monies are. And so we have to ensure that we have sufficient reserves going forward to protect the state and everyone else from any economic downturn or any budgetary issues that come up.
So how much do we have to carry in reserves that keeps us solvent?
There's been various metrics that have been used. We try to follow about 10% of the general fund revenues as an initial starting point. We are in the process of working through with a more formalized policy, a reserve policy. And so that hopefully will be coming out within the next several months or so. But for the time being, we're looking at a 10% or so benchmark in terms of reserves. Now, reserves, what we consider to be reserves are the general fund balances, and also for the emergency budget and reserve fund and the hurricane relief fund. Those three funds or balances are what we consider to be our reserves.
But not necessarily enough that would pay unfunded liabilities.
Not even close to it, unfortunately. Right. You know, our unfunded liabilities, I mean, now that you mention it, on the pension side at the last report is about $8.8 billion, not million, billion dollars. And with the health benefit side, the state's portion is about $8.5 billion. The total unfunded liability for the health, which includes the counties, is about $11.3 billion. So collectively, with the state and the counties, for those just those two benefits alone, amounts to close to $20 billion or so.
Which is why a lot of people are wondering how we're going to get out of all of that, especially if we see that a recession may be coming in the not-too-distant future.
And that's a great question, and that's why things have been done over the last few years to do, as an example, to reform some of the benefits to make sure that the liabilities don't escalate to a point where they become unmanageable or unsustainable, I should say. And so there have been reforms. There are other measures to try to help to put the monies in to better fund it or to fund both systems. And so that would hopefully lessen the strain on future taxpayers and future generations.
All right, we're going to talk more about unfunded liabilities in a little while, but I want to get Jan Yamane into this conversation. You've been sitting there quietly and patiently. As we've been talking about some of the issues that go into creating a budget, there's that issue of, well, what about all those special funds and things that are earmarked for a particular purpose, but do we really know that that purpose still needs to be met? Do we really understand whether those special funds have relevance now that kind of falls into your lap a little bit.
It does.
Periodically as you have to review all of those special funds.
That's correct. We have a statutory mandate that puts all of the special funds, revolving funds, trust funds on a five-year cycle by department. So in a five-year cycle, we should pretty much go through all of the departments as well as the judiciary. It's a pretty big task. You know, a few years ago, it was only the revolving and trust funds. And then most recently, the legislature did add on the special funds. So we found that the total number of funds has escalated quite a bit.
And how many? Give everybody an idea of how many.
Well, in any given year, we may do 200 plus reviews of funds. In other years, smaller, depending upon the size of the departments. In some cases, there are years where there are clustered departments. I think one year we had about 220 to review. Another year had different departments, and so the total was maybe closer to 150. I think we have two smaller years coming up, which we may have only between maybe 60 and 70. So a little bit of a respite from the really heavy years of the fund reviews.
But the total number of funds are what? Isn't that near 1,000?
I think it's probably closer to 700.
Still a lot, considering where they started from.
I think the most important thing that we've learned, though, is in talking with the money committees over at the legislature, House Finance, as well as Senate Ways and Means, they've indicated to us that without our funds reviews, they really don't have a good handle on just exactly how many funds we have. There is reporting that's required through the departments, but the reality is some of that reporting is not as good as it could be. There are situations when some agencies believe they do not need to report something. Others believe that or they just didn't know that the reporting requirement applied to certain funds that they haven't reported. Some of the administratively created funds, unlike the ones that must go through a change in the law, those are a little different, and so the administratively creative ones are sometimes not included in those reviews. So it's become very important. I know that, you know, there are several bills moving in both the House and the Senate this year focused on non-general funds. And what we do is, you know, fund by fund, we click through, we do an analysis, we get it out into our report. The money committees have been very aware of this work and have tried to follow through with a lot of the recommendations that we've made, whether the fund no longer suits the purpose, it has a zero balance in some cases, has been sitting just empty and not used, you know, clean the books, take them off. But that has to be done statutorily. And so the legislature has to put in the bill, go through the hearings process, make sure that it's vetted and then voted upon, and then sent up to the governor. So it's not as easy as it sounds to just eliminate special revolving and trust funds.
Despite how formidable very often your office is regarded, you still have issues with trying to get information and also having everybody understand that you are not as all-powerful as
That's
some would
correct.
Like you to be, and that, in fact, you take your marching orders from the legislature.
That's correct. We are a statutory, we have a constitutional office. We're only one of eight in the country. So we take that charge very highly. We are part of the legislative branch, which a lot of people don't realize. You know, remember the Back to Civics 101 with the legislative branch that makes the laws, the executive branch that implements the law, and then the judiciary that interprets the law. We're part of the legislature, so a very small part of government. My office is very small. We have 25 people. 20 of us work on audits of one or studies. We have a broad array of different kinds of work that we put out. We handle the audits for the state as well as studies, these funds reviews that we've been talking about, hundreds and hundreds of them. We also look at proposed funds. This time of the year when the legislative process is beginning and the bills are starting to flow, any bill that proposes to create a new fund, we have to do a quick analysis of that one as well. Now, interestingly enough, you know, you think that with all of this work on funds and the focus on trying to eliminate some of them that no longer serve the purpose, as soon as they eliminate some, they may just also create them as well.
And so they're offset,
that's right.
Your job isn't getting easier.
You may not see the number go down. In fact, we thought that with this new focus on trying to keep these funds in check, that there wouldn't be as many funds being proposed every year. But we just finished going through our count, and I think we have somewhere between 45 and 48 that are being proposed. It doesn't mean that they're all going to pass, But nonetheless, you know, we've seen a pretty steady number of proposed funds every year when we thought we would see them go down. So that's kind of an interesting, a little bit counterintuitive.
If you're just joining us now on Town Square, you were listening to Jan Yamani, the state acting auditor, and we're talking with her tonight about her office, what they do, and what's been happening in that office, a lot coming out over the last year. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Also joining us tonight is Wes Machida. He is the Director of Finance and heads of the Department of Budget and Finance, and he is here with us taking a look at what it is that we better understand about our budget and not just look at it as a word that accompanies a great deal of eye roll, and very often as people are trying to get some handle on how our taxpayer dollars are spent. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to George, calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, George, and thank you for your patience. George, you there? Okay. It sounds like we had a problem because it sounds like the line's open, but we can't get him. Anyway, if you'd like to join us and have a question about how do we put together this budget and what does it mean to have a balanced budget? There are often questions about what exists outside of the budget itself, what's counted, what's not counted. Wes Machida, can you speak to that just a little bit too? Because it's not as if you look at the whole thing and there is, you know, the whole budget. There are things that exist external to it, are there not?
Well, actually, if you're talking about the state's financial plan, that looks at the general fund balance. So there's, as we mentioned before, as state auditor mentioned before, there's a special fund. So that's outside of the financial plan. We're just looking at the general fund balance. What it means to have a balanced budget is that from the general fund standpoint, at any one point in time at the end of any year over a six-year period, the revenues have to, or the balance has to be a positive balance. It cannot be below zero. So that's what it means to have a balanced budget, that over a six-year period, and even in the projections, it cannot show a balanced budget. I mean, it cannot show anything lower than zero.
You can't run a deficit.
You can't run a deficit. And so if you do run a deficit, then you have to adjust the plan either to controlling expenditures to ensure that there's a balanced budget along the way.
All right. I understand we've got George back. All right, George. Hope that line is working now. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Yeah, I just had a question about the balance that, you know, you got to keep a balanced budget, yet we have this huge unfunded liability in the form of pensions. And I never understood how that's resolved under the law.
Okay, let's see if we can talk a little bit about that, because that's the thing that people want to talk about a great deal. And we always, you know, hear conversations about unfunded liabilities and what are we going to do about this. And if we're truly going to have a balanced budget, how do we create a mechanism for catching up when we know that money in future is not going to buy as much as it's going to buy right now, and that there may be some other situations like a recession or who knows what that may affect what the state is able to do that far in the future?
Yes. So, in fact, now GASB is the Government Accounting Standards Board. They're requiring reporting of the liability, so this unfunded liability by each employer, whereas previously it didn't have to be reported. It was off balance sheet, as they say. So it just was included as a footnote or like a note in the financial report. Now it has to be reported as a part of the balance sheet. Now, in terms of the budget itself and in terms of the unfunded liability in its current plan, if everything goes according to plans, would be paid down within a 26-year period. So you show each year as a payment coming through so that when the payments occur over a 26-year period, the unfunded liability, if everything holds as it should, then it'll be paid down. But it would take 26 years, according to the current plan, to do so.
And how does that dovetail when you add in pension?
That is the pension side of it. When you're looking at the health benefit side of it, it's projected to be paid down within a 30-year
period.
I'm
sorry. You're absolutely right. I asked you. Brain's not working so well at 5 o'clock sometimes. But yeah, what happens with the health side of it?
So the health side of it, again, would be paid down. The plan is to pay it down within a 30-year period. And so each year there's an annual required contribution payment that must be made by the various employers, the state and the city and the various counties. They must come in with their required contribution to pay down the unfunded liability over a 30-year period. And again, if all assumptions hold true, then the unfunded liability for the health side should be paid down. The question is also, would we have the ability to make those kinds of contributions, because the contributions are projected to increase over time, over that 26 or 30-year period? So that is the question that must be looked at, because it is also competing against, again, the other services that need to be provided by to the public. So there are competing resources for not only paying down the pension and the health benefit liabilities, but also for the other services that are being provided.
That's always where we come down to it, what's going to compete. But then again, you've said now a couple of times, if everything holds as it should, based on assumptions, what are those assumptions?
There are at least 20 to 30 different assumptions. Some of the more important ones with respect to the unfunded liability with pensions and health benefits is the projected life expectancy of the various members or employees or retirees of the systems. So if people start living longer than anticipated, there's a certain projected life expectancy for the average member or the average participant. And that's about 82, 83 years of age. Now, if the average starts pushing out to a longer life expectancy, as an example, to 86 or 87, then there's more pensions that need to be paid. There's more health benefit contributions that need to be made or premiums that have to be paid. And so there's going to be more monies that are needed in order to make those payouts. So when I say assumptions, that those assumptions such as life expectancies have to hold true. If they don't, then more monies may be needed.
Wes Machida, though, wouldn't that be an assumption that would be rather prudent to make, given the fact that we're watching longevity increase, and particularly in Hawaii, where we have the longest-lived group of folks anywhere? Wouldn't that be something to, you know, put into the plan?
And actually, it is actually currently in the plan. So there's a mechanism to review historically what has transpired in terms of life expectancy, as an example. And adjustments are made to the life expectancy as needed along the way. With the pension side, every 5 years, there's an experience study that's being done. So the experience study looks at what happened 5 years back and up until current. And it determines whether the assumption for life expectancy is accurate or not. And if it's not, then it's changed going forward.
All right, I want to stay with assumptions for a second here and just ask you, of all the assumptions that you know, some of which you've talked about and some of which we haven't yet talked about, how worried are you when it comes to all the unfunded liabilities and also being able to pay in to those people who may age much more than hadn't been anticipated?
Well, for us and for me in particular, it is an area of concern, because anything can happen. It's hard to predict what's going to happen in the future, but you want to make sure that you're prepared for any difficulties that do happen in the future. So it is an area of concern. We have a better handle on it today than we did yesterday. So we feel comfortable that there's a plan in place, at least to ensure that if there are adjustments that need to be made, we will make them. If there's things that we need to take a look at, we will look at it. We are continuing to look at ways to manage the liability and to fund the contributions in a better way.
All right, we're going to take a caller. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Open venue tonight, talking with our state acting auditor, Jan Yamane, and Wes Machida, the state finance director. And if you're concerned about money matters and Hawaii's future, you might want to make a call, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. As we go to Sean calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Sean. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, aloha. My question is for Wes Machida. You know, I'm just looking at long-term prospects. My question is whether or not the state has ever considered, I would call it a prospective overhaul of the defined benefit pension as well as the health benefit. I mean, it just seems that the cost of this long term is enormous, and it's only going to continue to grow. So perhaps considering setting an end date for when people can vest for these benefits, but then moving forward, any new employees would have to agree to a new type of benefit, maybe more of a 401k type thing for the instead of a pension, and really giving up the 10-year vesting, 15-year vesting, 25-year vesting, and maybe making it just 25 years, because not all employees will work the full 25 years.
All right, John, thanks very much. But this is sort of the tiered conversation that we've had for many years. Private sector has done that in some ways with removing certain benefits, and as you enter in at a younger age, that you may get something less than what someone who is a bit older and has been working a little differently than you have might get. Is that something that should be sufficiently looked at for government? Do you think it has been?
We actually have looked at that. And one of the things that should be noted, and thank you, Sean, I appreciate the question. One of the things that should be noted is that about 5 years ago, we went through a pension reform. And so with the pension reform for members that started after a certain time period, more specifically after June 30th, 2012, they have reduced benefits, and they're significantly reduced from a cost standpoint. Here's the example. Prior to that time, what the employers are required to put in for an employee over a 12-month period is 6% of their pay. With the new benefit structure, the reform that took place, the cost gets reduced from 6% of their pay to 1.5% of their pay. So it's a significant decline. We've also looked at, in previous studies, whether there should be a restructuring to the defined benefit. The difficulty with that is because the unfunded liability is so large. To make the transition to a defined contribution plan from a defined benefit plan would entail a lot more monies over the first 15 years, a lot more. One of the difficulties we have, too, is that there's a constitutional provision that protects the accrued vested benefits of the employee. And so that is protected by constitution. So things that are done would have to be done going forward. So a lot of those things have been looked at. Some of the reforms, as I mentioned before have been passed, luckily, through the legislative process. And I have to thank the legislators for doing so. They took a bold step by making that change, but it'll be a change that would help future generations.
All right, Sean, thanks very much for the question. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. You might not have gotten some of this in civics class, but you can pick up some of it tonight as we're talking about the state's budget, how it's crafted, what goes into it, what is a problem for some people. And we've been talking about unfunded liabilities for such a long time and the health and welfare of the state of Hawaii, financially speaking. And also, who checks up on that? That person would be the woman sitting to my left, Jan Yamane, the state acting auditor, looking at things that show up in the news and a lot that does not. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because every time there's a major report that's released, and especially when it's critical, like whether it was critical of rail or whether it was critical of certain special funds or what may be happening with the Kolea system that didn't work properly for the ACA, those things tend to get a lot of press. But that's only part of what you do. Do you ever feel that somehow you are, pushed into a corner with some of these reports that you issue and that people only want you to go out there and find some of the really negative information?
Yeah, that's one of those things that it's a difficult balance. You know, everyone thinks that we only do audits, these big audits of agencies and programs. But in fact, our work is so varied that we do spend a lot of our time and a lot of our resources doing other kinds of work, like the funds work that we talked about. We do studies for Sunrise when there's a new regulation that's proposing to be regulated. We do what's called a Sunrise review. On the back end, if a regulation is going to be repealed, then before it's repealed, we do a sunset review. analysis. We do, you know, mandatory health initiatives, insurance initiatives, where insurance is going to be mandated. We do a study with that. There's any number of other areas that we're asked to look at that are not audits. So much of our work is spread across a number of different fields. I don't think a lot of people realize that we have a real mixed bag of work, and not just the audits. The audits tend to get most of the press. You know, people are interested in finding out how the health connector is working or not working, or when we do procurement audits of the various agencies. But there's a lot of work that we do. Much of it is statutorily mandated, so it, and some of it is directed by the legislature. So it's just a matter of getting it all done and getting it all out.
Put this one to bed, though. Very often we will have listeners call us and say things like, why doesn't the state auditor do a complete and comprehensive audit of the DOE?
That's actually an audit that has been talked about for years and years. I think the last one was done decades ago. Every year, I think this is probably the first year in a long time that I haven't seen a bill that has requested us to do a comprehensive, you know, top-to-bottom audit of DOE. It doesn't mean that it couldn't yet happen. The concurrent resolutions that we often get our work from, that deadline hasn't come, and it doesn't come until mid-March or so. But at least among the bills that I've seen so far, the ones that have been requesting audits, DOE is not one of them. We have told legislators, just from a practical standpoint, that if you wanted something top to bottom on an agency as large as DOE, it is statewide, it is an enormous agency, they would have to establish that that is their one priority for maybe a full 2 years of our work.
And would you be able to handle that with just the people you have in your office, or you'd have to hire out too?
We'd be asking for a very large appropriation to give us some firepower if we had to go to every school on every island, at every complex, up at the administration level. These big audits are extremely resource intensive, and we would need additional resources in order to be able to carry it out. So I know that, you know, on some of the bills this cycle, the legislature is looking at possibilities of things like management and financial audits of Hawaii Health Systems Corporation, which is another very big organization. There's another bill that's asking for a complete, you know, audit of the University of Hawaii system. So that's not just UH Manoa. That's everything included in the system. Some of them, you know, have appropriations attached to the bills, and others of them don't. As these bills move forward, you know, we'll probably be asked at some point, if we were to, you know, give this to you, what kind of monies would you need to carry it out?
Should they have asked you that before they put in the bill, to have a real understanding of what is feasible and what's possible, and what the cost associated with that would be?
I think most of the legislators do know what it takes to do one of these big audits. But many of them have issues that they've heard, constituents have called in, have raised concerns. Many of them have worked with these agencies or for a long time. They're the committee chair in the House or the Senate. So they know intimately some of these issues, and have a great interest in trying to, you know, get to the bottom of some of what they don't understand as being an inefficient way of running government. So many of them do know, but I think a lot of it is all a question of legislative priorities, and that's something that Wes was talking about as well. You know, there's only so many dollars to go around. There's only so many resources to go around. So each year the legislature has to set its priorities, and we are one of the mechanisms, I guess, that carries them out. Whenever there's an audit request that's in a bill or a resolution, we don't testify as to whether they should do it or not. We believe very strongly that that's the policy call of the legislature. We will weigh in if they ask us for how much money we might need, or if there's something about the measure that needs to be amended that doesn't comport with what we do. But in general, we stay away from those questions because that's what the legislature's work is.
And that's an important point, because yes, there are a lot of people who somehow believe that you weigh in on policy.
And, which we do not.
And you don't. You simply talk about the feasibility of...
That's correct.
Yeah.
We'll help to craft a measure to make it doable, feasible, you know, or try to... Sometimes we'll help craft language that will get to the heart of what they're asking or what they really want to know. But when it comes to the question of whether to do it, now that is the call of the legislature. That's their policy call.
Which brings us back to you, Wes Matrina, too, because as we are looking at many of these bills are just coming through, we're still in the not early stages, but still moving toward crossover to see what's going to stick and what we're really going to look at in the second half. As you look at the budget, and clearly we've heard what the governor says, and that was something that you crafted, obviously, what are those things in there that you're seeing that might well be entirely thwarted by some of the legislature's different perspectives on some of the same issues that we talk about and that we think about as, you know, sort of top of mind issues? What is it that you think is being particularly problematic for this year?
I think it happens actually every year that they go through and there's introduced various bills that require appropriations. A number of them, though, have blank items in terms of what should be appropriated. And one of the reasons, too, is probably because it's difficult to determine the cost at this standpoint in terms of what should be included. And so without those numbers, though, it's really difficult for us to determine from a financial plans perspective what the impact would be. Now, there's categories that maybe we could anticipate that would envision a large appropriation requirement. But at this point, it's early in the session. It's difficult to tell what is going to go through or not. And so we're waiting to see how far they get through the various committees, whether it be a single referral bill or a double or a triple referral bill. But we're just waiting to see which bills cross over to, and then from that standpoint, we can determine better what the financial impact or fiscal impact on the state's financial plan would be.
It's always tough when we look at some of those bills now and we just see a blank there. And you wonder, well, you know, how is that going to be looked at as being a feasible thing to do if you really don't know how much money is attached to it? And if you put money in there for that, that means that something else obviously has to be decreased if you only have so much money, which in some ways I would imagine would thwart what you do or make it really frustrating for you to look at some of the priorities that you have as being essential.
And that's one of the difficulties for the legislature too, especially for the money committees, to determine what the financial or fiscal impact would be, because they essentially go through the same or similar process that we go through. We have to look at everything within the state budget. They also have to look at everything within the state budget. So in various ways, we go through a lot of the similar processes and trying to identify, set priorities, try to identify what can be included versus what cannot be included, just as we do so in our recommendation to the governor for his budget.
On Town Square tonight, we're taking a look at how the state budget is crafted, and also how we are assured that there is some accountability. That would be what in many ways comes out of the state acting auditor's office. Tonight, both state acting auditor Jen Yamane and Wes Machida, the director of finance, are here, and you too. And if you're worried about how your taxpayer dollars are spent, or you're looking and you really don't understand how it can happen the way it does sometimes, well, tonight you have access to both of them to ask your question, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Budgeting is daunting even just on the home front, let alone when you're talking about a state budget that very often gets convoluted and difficult to understand. If there's something that you don't quite understand and wish you understood better, give us a call, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Very often we see bills that frustrate each other and aren't necessarily in concert with each other, yet they seem to be talking about the same topic. It often feels like let's throw up something against the wall and see what sticks. When you're talking about the best and highest use of money and also being able to check back and see that money is well used, are there holes in understanding and policy that should be better understood before a bill is even crafted, particularly when you're talking about large expenditures of money?
I believe so. One of the things that you have to look at is this program or the use of the monies, how is it going to continue? And how far into the future is it going to continue? Because that has to be factored into the financial plan. If it's a one-time expenditure, as an example, then that is easier to place within the financial plan than something that would be going on indefinitely. So as an example, when new programs start up and the need for operating monies are required, the question is whether does it fit into the current six-year financial plan and even beyond that? And what are the increases, the potential increases that might be happening in the future as well, too? That has to be projected. So before any bill is introduced, it would be helpful to have a lot of those questions answered, setting in a structure that would make it as efficient as possible in terms of operating if it's a new program, as an example. So there's a number of things that probably could be done before bills are introduced, and it's likely that they're already happening, that it has happened, that people are doing their due diligence in making sure that before a bill is introduced, that they have thought through and provided as much detail as possible.
Even to make sure that something might be even constitutional before it's proposed.
And that is correct. That's one of the things that they should be looking at in terms of the legal issues involved. So it's not only looking at the business side of it, but also looking at it from the legal standpoint as well.
All right, we're going to go to Tom calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Tom. Welcome to Town Square. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to ask Jan, why hasn't the legislator increased the size of her office so that they could do a better job at bringing the state into a better fiscal, accountability and find out, you know, where a lot of this frivolous spending is being done?
All right,
part of the legislator to kind of keep that under wraps so it doesn't show how bad they're doing?
Oh, well, maybe not anything as nefarious as that. But looking at the idea of building out your office, has there been any real discussion about that?
There has not been. You know, we have taken on additional responsibilities over the years. One of those responsibilities was brought to us in 2003, I think, when we took back the financial statement audits that used to be handled through the executive branch, and it was just a function of timing. Back in the day when the financial statement audits first started being done for the state, the Office of the Auditor hadn't been formally set up yet, although we were already created constitutionally. So in 2003, they did decide that it was time for the auditor's office to really take back that function because then it would be a separation with the independence and the objectivity. It would be back in the legislative branch and away from the executive branch. With that function, we did build out a little bit of a kind of the financial side of the office that does manage the contracts that we have for all of that work. But we have never been asked or told that we should expand the size of our office, and I believe that would be a decision that the legislature would have to make.
But I'm glad you're happy to hear that somebody is raising that question for you, and it's not you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you want to join our conversation, we're talking about looking after the money, crafting the state budget, and making sure that those tax dollars are well spent and there is transparency and accountability. That falls into the purview of the state auditor very often. But then again, her activities are directed by the legislature, so what their priorities may not necessarily be yours. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you want to share yours. We're going to go now to Michael calling from Mililani. Aloha, Michael. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. You know, I noticed that issues all of a sudden take more precedence and interest, like air conditioning in the schools. It's all of a sudden become a hot topic, and money is being thrown at it. But how do we decide what is important to put money towards? Because we have federally mandated needs like taking care of our sewage treatment systems.
All right, Michael, thank you. Well, some of those priorities come out of citizens. Some of them come from lawmakers listening to their constituents. Some of them are simply things that we have to take care of and that we are federally mandated to do.
I think a lot of that really has to do with what the work of the legislature is. You know, all of these priorities come to the legislature and are vetted through bills, lots of public hearings. You know, many of those hearings are available online now. You can go onto Alelo and watch them. The website process that they have for tracking bills is so much more robust than it used to be. All those priorities, you know, come into the legislature via the various legislators introducing bills and other resolutions, and they're vetted. That's the whole process, is to try and get all those ideas and and different competing interests on the table. Like we've talked about, there's only so many dollars to go around. So, you know, participatory democracy really only works when you participate. So you will be heard. You know, contact your legislators and push for the measures that you believe are really on the hot button issues for this year.
But also understand that you are talking about something that has to fit into a whole.
That's correct.
And that there are those competing interests, and the best of the best, or that which serves the highest good of the highest good, very often will determine what happens with those dollars. Again, that's open to interpretation. But as we were talking earlier with Wes Machida, and I asked him how concerned he is for the health, the financial health of Hawaii, because you look at it from a different angle, I'll ask you the same question. How concerned are you about the financial health of Hawaii?
I think the administrations have really made it a really important issue for them to become better at their financial reporting. The administration has really looked towards, I think, committing the kinds of resources to pay down the unfunded mandates, as well as to show the investors that they really are putting their right foot forward. One of those things was in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, the CAFR. My office is the one that handles the contract, but it's really the executive branch that has the resources to put that report together, to roll up all of those financial statements. It's a very big operation to move that one report. And in the last 2 years, we've been able to deliver that report on time. It hadn't been delivered on time for, I want to say, 7 years. And so at one point, I think Hawaii was probably the last state in the country to put in its CAFR, almost 9 or 10 months late, with the commitment that the executive branch has made towards timely reporting. What has occurred is that I believe when Director Machida goes to bond market and talks to the investors, they see that the commitment is there and that Hawaii is really making strides forward to not only address the mandates and the other unfunded liabilities, but also to be timely with their financial reporting. It has made a huge difference for us at the bond market, and I'm sure Director can speak to that.
At the moment, though, can we take another caller? Because I promise we get somebody else in here. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joanne calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Joanne.
Hi. I was wondering, do we have any idea how much of the state budget is spent on consent decrees or settlements or any sort of lawsuits where the government has been sued for basically a failure to govern adequately?
All right. Thank you, Joanne, for that question. Anything? I mean, I'm trying to think about what I remember, but in terms of consent decrees or other issues where the state has been sued and has to pay for the legal fees associated with that.
There is a bill that is put in every year by the Department of the Attorney General that compiles or consolidates all of the settlement claims that have been reached over the course of the year that are ready to be paid out.
Do you remember
out.
What this year's is?
I don't know offhand what the total is, and I don't remember the bill number either.
I don't remember either, but it's the litigation fund, I believe.
There you go. That makes that three of us who don't know.
Yeah.
And I believe it probably is in the millions, but we would have to check just to, you know, to make sure. But as State Auditor mentioned, yes, there is a fund that's within the Attorney General's budget that provides for monies involving litigations against claims against the state.
But claims against the state, when you say that it millions could be tens of millions or it could be under 10 million given the state's budget. And I mean, when we talk about billions of dollars, can you give any sort of ballpark of where you think that liability fund lies?
It varies so dramatically from year to year, depending upon the settlements, and I don't recall the ballpark number.
I don't recall either, but I'm not sure. I don't believe it's over $10 million, so I believe it's under that.
All right. Thanks, Joanne, for that question. So that really, given the proportion of the budget, is not huge. It's not like a lot of money is walking away because of legalities. Finally, we've got a few more minutes before we have to say goodbye. What is it that you think about this year's budget that maybe speaks differently to where Hawaii is in its evolution than perhaps we even would have been talking about last year?
I think one of the things in terms of this year's budget is the fact that we are currently, we're building reserves. We are building reserves. We're really looking at it really in a thoughtful way in terms of the amount of monies that we spend each year. Because it's important for us to be able to live within our means, as the governor had stated before. And that helps to protect future generations as well, too. We do have to balance it against the increased service demands that are out there. But at the same time, we do have to be fiscally responsible. So I think this year we're really taking a hard look at where we need to be in the future with respect to the monies that we have available and the reserves that we have available in particular.
Given the fact that we know that population is likely going to increase, and so is longevity.
That is correct. In our financial plan, we do have built into that financial plan, because we project out for about a 5-6 year period. We do have it built in for increases as well, too. So we do account for some of that, but there are things that come up along the way from year to year that's unexpected. Something, and that's one of the reasons why we have to have sufficient reserves.
And Jan Yamane, I want to ask you, too, as we are closing out this hour, what's next on your list? If you had your druthers and you could pick and choose and not necessarily have the legislature tell you what you need to go look at, is there something that you think that we especially need to be focusing on that we're not?
I think one of the things that we always wanted to spend more time on is procurement. We've already had some discussion with the State Procurement Office for training for our staff to get to another higher level of procurement expertise. And I think one of the things that the agencies in general have a very difficult time with is procurement.
What would that mean for you to get to that next level?
Well, I think it's one thing to take baseline training or to understand how the procurement law works. It's another thing to really have a higher understanding so that we use the procurement law and all of the circulars as our criteria for any of the audits that we do. The more you understand about something, you know, the better it is that you can apply it and see what the differences are. Doing an audit is really almost like a formula. You know, you take the law or the criteria, whatever it is, and that's in your mind what it should be, and then you match it up against what it is, and you find out what the difference is. So in a lot of ways, the more you know about the law or the criteria that drives your work, the better your findings can be.
So procurement is on your list and better training for procurement.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a particular part or of a department that you think that we need to be looking at more?
No, you know, there are a lot of state agencies that do quite a bit of procurement. And I think the ones that do more of it, while they may have more money at stake, many of them have better systems because they do it so frequently. Other ones that don't do it as often, they sometimes struggle because it's not an area of expertise for them. So I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, just the big dollars that you'd be going after. It'd be trying to get, I think, the entire state to be just better at its purchasing.
Well, I hope you get your wish.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for spending the last hour with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Jan Yamane is the acting state auditor. And to Wes Machida, thank you so much for being here, the state budget and finance director. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And we will see you tomorrow morning back here at 8 o'clock for another run at The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you then.